Have you ever longed to escape reality? Or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. It's not every day you get to talk to an artist like Shakira, and I'll tell you why. First off, if you only know Shakira from her English records, you probably recognize this song. Just an unreal song with the pan flute in the background. Isn't that great? Shakira, Whenever, Wherever. She had big hits all over radio and TV in Canada. I mean, this was the soundtrack to Dancing in a Circle at a Much Music Video Dance, I'll tell you that much. But let me just run down the accolades for you so you get a sense of Shakira's impact globally. She sold over 100 million albums, won over 500 awards for her music. She is the best-selling female Latin artist of all time. A few years ago, MTV named her one of the most influential women in the history of music, the only Latina on this list. And we talk a little bit about this, as Latin music is becoming the biggest music in the world, with artists like Bad Bunny leading the charge. People look to Shakira as the artist who broke down those walls. So you also need to know that the past few years haven't been easy for Shakira. She says pretty early on in our conversation that she's been going through hell. So first off was a really messy and public breakup with her partner of 11 years, the father of her children, the Barcelona footballer Gerard Piqué. Then you might have read about this in the news. Spanish prosecutors charged Shakira with tax fraud. The court gave her a 3-year suspended sentence and a $7 million fine. And then her dad, who has been the biggest supporter of her career right from the very beginning, and she talks about that, he got really sick. I'm telling you this stuff not because this is like a gossipy thing, but because at the beginning of our conversation, she sort of alludes to the hardships she's been facing over the years and how she wanted to channel those hardships and everything she learned by going through them through her new record. That new record is beautiful. It's called Las Mujeres Ya No Lloran, which in English means women no longer cry, or maybe like women don't cry anymore. It sounds a little like this. So that's a song from the record called La Fuerte. I got the chance to visit Shakira, where she's living these days. She's in Miami. I want to set the scene because we never really did an interview like this before. We're on the top floor of this hotel. There was a massive thunderstorm raging right outside the window. And it was midnight, later than we have ever done an interview on Q. Shakira, though, she was in the mood to chat. Here's our conversation. Shakira, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm well. Congratulations on the album. I really loved it.
Thank you so much. Really?
Yeah, I really did. I really love listening
to
it.
So great to hear you. Thank you so much.
How are you feeling now that it's out?
Relieved. So happy. Reading the comments from my fans. Just so emotional about everything. I'm adrenalized and inspired to give them more, to go on tour, to meet them in person and just celebrate this moment. I've been waiting for this for so long. I've worked so hard on this album for months and months, and it just feels really great to see the recognition and to feel appreciated and valued as an artist. It's amazing. My fans have been there the whole time, every step of the way, accompanying me, injecting me with passion for what I do, sustaining me in bad times, celebrating me in good times, and I can't express how amazing my fans are with me. They've been so loyal and so noble, and they're everything to me. So I'm just so thankful, you know, now that the album is out. It's not mine anymore, it's theirs, and
yeah,
it's a great feeling.
It's a really beautiful album, and I want to talk a little bit about the construction behind it, mm-hmm. because I can't think of an album I listened to that had so many different, like, genres of music on it. You know, like, there were moments of, like, pop. But there's also this beautiful kind of moments of rock music. There's a sort of a yeah. great Norteña moment.
Uh-huh.
There's sort of that El Jefe tune, which is sort of...
Like ska?
Yeah, yeah.
The ska, Mexican ska.
When you went
Afrobeat, reggaeton, ballads.
Keep going.
Yeah. May I?
Yeah.
Pop. Yeah.
How?
I think I ran out of genres.
how intentional was that when you were going into the making of this record? Like, did you know what you wanted to do stylistically? How did you choose that?
Nothing about this album is intentional. It's a conceptual album, but that was never the purpose. No one intends to go through the hardship and the difficult things that I went through when I was writing this, when I was raw, with a knife between my teeth, when I was licking my wounds. But, you know, life gives you lemons and you make lemonade. And what I did is, what I made is songs. I made songs, you know. And that's the way I healed through this process. And as I was, well, I'm still healing, but definitely these songs were a big part of that, of my that medicine, you know. They were writing the songs, creating the songs was the most therapeutic thing I found during these past months. And while I was creating them, I was just exploring and curious and experimenting and just enjoying my time in the studio, having this encounter with myself, rebuilding myself, and kind of getting to know a little bit more about myself, about my inner strength, of what I was able to do. So, really, the genres are just the genres that I experimented with are just a response, and every song had its demands, and every song told me and dictated to me at every single moment what I was supposed to do, and I just followed my instincts. I didn't really premeditate anything, or I don't believe in following formulas or in listening to record executives, you know,
yeah.
or paying attention to what's in right now, what's in style. I just follow my impulses. So that's how this album was made, out of impulses, out of the necessity, the compulsion to express myself, to elaborate intense emotions and feelings and anger and frustration and all of that. And it ended up being transformed into other things, you know?
What do you mean by you use the word medicine, like writing this music and creating this music became medicine for you.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? What do you mean?
Well, I think catharsis is the word. I was going through so many things that were so hard to deal with. I was in the mud, and I had to rebuild myself somehow. I had to pick up the pieces of myself, you know, bone by bone.
Yeah.
Put them together again.
Yeah.
And music was the glue. And in that process, my fans were there. My audience was there. Understanding me, supporting me, giving me back my confidence, showing me that I was stronger than what I thought I was, you know. I felt very weak at times. I felt very vulnerable at times. But then writing these songs, making this music, made me regain strength. And Yeah, I remember when we were just remembering before how I started this whole process with the first song, Monotonia.
Fue culpa tuya, ni tampoco mía. Fue culpa de la monotonía. Nunca dije nada, pero me dolía. Yo sabía que esto pasaría.
I was torn. It was a huge effort for me to go in the studio and start working again.
Why?
Because I was literally walking like a zombie.
No fue culpa tuya, ni tampoco mía. Fue culpa de la monotonía. Nunca dije nada, pero me dolía. Yo sabía que esto pasaría.
I couldn't believe what was happening to me, what was happening with my life, how my dreams were all crumbling in front of my eyes. The dissolution of a family is a pretty big deal. It's probably the most traumatic event, one of the most traumatic events of my entire life. And then added to that, I had all the losses and all the things that happened to me that I don't want to get into all that now.
Yeah,
but you know, when it rains, it pours.
Yeah.
And difficulties just come in together. Suddenly you have periods of stability and peace.
Calm.
And then all of a sudden you have to deal with hell.
Yeah.
So that's what happened to me. Yeah. I went to hell and came back from it. My ability to create music, and that artistic experience is what gave me, it was my salvation. It saved me. And knowing that I had fans out there, that was my safety net.
Yeah,
that was
people who would listen to you and love you.
Oh,
and,
my God, my fans are the best fans in the whole world.
How did you feel when you actually wrote the songs? Like when you were writing these sort of very cathartic songs,
mm-hmm.
when you were, I don't know what you do. Do you write with a pen or on your phone or anything like that? You know, or
on my phone sometimes. Sometimes I use the good old pen.
Yeah. What were the feelings you sort of had in your body and in your mind as these things were coming out? Do you know what I mean?
Different kind of feelings, you know, because the road to healing is not linear.
Yeah.
There's valleys and peaks and curves and there are good days and bad days and there's ups and downs and it's a process. But the important thing is that this album contains 16 songs that have a narrative and a language, but they're full of variants.
Yeah.
And dynamics, and there's moments of frustration and anger, and there's moments of celebration and triumph and and a newfound strength and celebrating that strength and resilience, and there's a little bit of everything, you know.
Yeah, joy.
And so now that this album is out, it's a very personal album. But now that it's out, is like I said before, it's not mine anymore. It belongs to so many people that I know can feel represented in these songs that are that contain emotions that are universal.
Yeah.
You know, because human suffering it's universal. It's prehistoric, but also, you know, celebration and joy. It's part of all of that is part of human life.
Me enseñaste que el amor no es una estafa y que cuando es real no se acaba. Intenté que no me veas llorar, que no veas mi fragilidad. Pero las cosas no son siempre como las soñamos. A veces corremos, pero no llegamos.
So you're listening to my conversation with Shakira about her brand new album, Las Mujeres Ya No Lloran. The song you're listening to right now is this song called Acróstico. And I should let you know that this album has a lot of collaborators on it. Cardi B's on it, Bizarrap, Rauw Alejandro, Karol G. Big, big stars on the album. But when I heard that song, Acróstico, I was curious about who was on it. Because if you don't know, the song is from Shakira to her children, talking about what they're going through as their parents break up. And I was struck by who joined her on this song, and I wanted to ask her about it. Take a listen.
I wanted to ask about Acrostico.
Mm-hmm.
I love that song almost more than any other song on the record.
Wow.
Can you tell people who are listening just who the... By the way, great collaborators
on
this record.
Two collaborators?
Yeah, because like, oh yeah, I got Cardi B in the record. It's great. And Carol G in the record. That's really good. Please tell people the collaborators.
These
on this
are the
one.
Best collaboration. This doesn't get better than that. These collaborators are my two sons. They were 8 and 10 when they participated in the song. It wasn't planned.
How did that happen?
I wrote this song for them, and it's in acrostic, which is it's like. If you read it in, well, I don't know for the English speakers, but for the Spanish speakers, if you read it vertically,
yes.
You see the names of my sons, Milan and Sasha. That's
an
acrostic. So yeah. Each letter of their names is the beginning of each sentence. First verse is Milan, second verse is Sasha. That's why it's called acrostic.
That's beautiful.
Acrostico. But when they heard the song, they said, "Oh, mom." They used to visit me in the studio and just hang out. And when they listened to the song, they said, "Mom, can we sing? They started to sing into the mic, and they sounded great. And they were like, "Can we be in the song?" And I was like, "Well, I don't know. I had doubts about it, but." They were like, "Please, please! You always told us that if we do something for ourselves and if we exploit our talents, that you would that is a good thing." And I said, "Yeah, I've always said that." So okay, record. They wanted to record. They wanted to be in the video. They wanted to play.
How did you feel? How did you feel when they were singing?
It's so special. So emotional. Emotional. It's. I'm telling you, it doesn't get better than that, than to see your own children singing and playing to a song that you wrote for them. It's the most special thing you can ever imagine.
Sirve de anestesia al dolor, hace que me sienta mejor. Para lo que necesites estoy, viniste a completar lo que soy.
Do you think ever about that they'll grow up and hear this record and hear themselves and you sing on that?
That's true. It's an immortalized moment, no? In which they... It's a moment in time. We've been through so much together.
Yeah, fair enough.
And... But we've come out of it stronger, I think, more humane. And my kids are tremendously empathetic, perhaps because they had to face many things that maybe not all kids of their age have faced. And
it strikes me. Well, thanks for talking about that. Well, it strikes me that so they're like what 11 and 9 now.
Now 11 and 9, yeah.
That's around the same age you were. When you first started writing songs, too.
That's true.
Is that right?
Yeah, I started writing songs when I was 8.
Yeah.
And
about your dad, right?
Yeah, the first one was inspired by my dad, but not about him. They were imaginary songs and about imaginary, situations. And then, when I was 10, I started doing my first performances, making some money.
Yeah, nice.
Bought my first car when I was 15.
Come on.
With a fake license.
Where'd you get that? Never mind. But hold on. When you were writing songs when you were a kid, did you get any idea that you were good?
No, but seriously, I was able to I played in every bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
And sweet 16 party.
Yeah.
And every company's internal companies' parties, and they used to pay me, few dollars here, a few dollars there, and pesos in that case.
Yeah.
Until I, you know, was able to save and buy my own car.
Pretty
when
good.
I was 15, which was my dream. I just wanted to have a car.
Did you get some? Did someone tell you like, hey, you're gifted. You're seeing music in a sort of a different way. Was there a moment where someone kind of said to you, hey, you might see music differently than everybody else?
My dad. When he listened to me singing in the car, you know, when you go on road trips, and someone starts singing. And, you know, my dad started to sing, and I would follow, and he said, wow, listen to Shakira's voice. She has a very potent, powerful voice. And I was like, potent? What does it mean? But it made me feel so special. And my mom always injected a lot of trust in myself. My mom used to tell me, you can be president. You can be anything you want. President of Colombia, if you want. I'm like, well, I don't know about President of Colombia, but she certainly made me feel that I was capable. And I try to do the same with my kids. Esto es pa' que te mortifique, mastique, trague, trague, mastique. Yo contigo ya no regreso, ni que me llore, ni me suplique. Entendí que no es culpa mía que te critique. Yo solo hago música, perdón que te salpique.
From her new album, Las Mujeres Ya No Lloran, that is Shakira featuring Bizarrap with their big hit single, Bizarrap Music Sessions Volume 53. Catchy title. After the break, you're going to hear Shakira reflect on some of her early English language hits. English language hits and the risk she was facing when she released that album, Laundry Service. More with Shakira after this on Cue.
Hi, I'm Willa Paskin, the host of Decoder Ring, Slate's podcast about cracking cultural mysteries. On Decoder Ring, we dive down rabbit holes and obsessively explore questions hiding in plain sight. Like, why has slow dancing gone out of style? And when did we all become obsessed with hydration? And where did the word mullet, you know, to describe a hairstyle, come from? That's Decoder Ring, named one of the best podcasts of 2023 by the New York Times. Listen to new episodes every 2 weeks and make sure to follow us so you never miss one.
Shakira. I never really knew that she could dance like this. She make a man wanna speak Spanish. Como se llama? Bonita. Picasso. Shakira.
Oh, baby, when you talk like that, you make a woman go mad.
So that's Hips Don't Lie, that's Shakira and Wyclef Jean. Can I tell you the downside of that song being such a big hit when you're about to talk to Shakira is that you're like 20 minutes. One of the things about doing this job is you just don't want to catch yourself like humming an old hit or saying something stupid because something's in your head. And the whole time I was getting ready to go in and talk to Shakira, all I could think was, don't say Shakira, Shakira. Don't say Shakira, Shakira. And I kept on saying, yeah, Shakira, Shakira. I would walk around the room going, Shakira, Shakira. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with one of the most successful artists in modern music history. I know I'm prone to hyperbole, but it's really true when you're talking to Shakira. Because before she was releasing like English language hits like Hips Don't Lie and Whenever, Wherever, she was already a massive success in Latin music. But to grow her career, she wanted to transition to English. And now you don't necessarily have to do that as a Latin artist now, but back in those days you did. And Shakira talks a little bit about that. She also talks about how it was in a language. English was a language she didn't speak at the time. And in this part of our conversation, I want to pick it up here. She learned how to write in English by listening to and reading one of Canada's greatest poets. Here's the rest of my conversation with Shakira.
Well, what's interesting is that you ended up having so much more of an impact than your average musician. Like, I remember, so I'm from, like we talked about before, I'm from Canada and like from a weird part of Canada.
This island in the middle of the Atlantic.
This made-up island in the middle of the ocean. And so it was Laundry Service. It was Whenever, Wherever. That was the song that kind of got me. Of course, you know, like that was the, you know.
Yeah.
But there was a girl in our town, like in our social group, from Colombia.
Really?
And I remember when we were all dancing to
a Colombian girl in the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah. She was very cold. And I remember we were she was very, very cold. And we were like all dancing to the song, and a song would play on the radio. We'd flip out and dance.
Whenever, wherever, we're meant to be too.
I remember her going like, you guys don't even know. You don't even know Shakira. Like, I've been listening to her for like 10, 15
years. I know better than you.
Yeah, and like, I have all of her albums before now, before this English language stuff. And we were like, so it was really, I saw her at Mass. Like, she was talking about all that kind of stuff. And it really strikes me that, well, maybe I'll ask the question.
My Colombian fans are the best PRs.
To have, yeah, they really did.
Yeah, oh my God.
To have all of that success and then to, at that point, switch to English for that record. Can you explain to me how much of a risk that felt like? Can you help me understand that?
That was nerve-wracking. I barely spoke English. I don't even ask me how I wrote an entire album in English. I did it. I remember reading Leonard Cohen.
Oh,
and
Canadian.
Yeah, Canadian. I was trying to understand how rhymes worked.
Do you remember what Leonard Cohen was?
Can you remind me?
Was it Suzanne takes you down? Was it So Long, Marianne?
Yeah, that one, yeah.
It's time we began
And I bought a book of Leonard Cohen's writing and lyrics. And,
oh, cool.
And that helped me understand a lot about like rhymes and... And I bought a thesaurus and English-Spanish dictionary. And that's how I wrote Objection, which I remember was my first song in English. And it made it in the album. Yeah, it made it in the Laundry Service album. Then I did Underneath Your Clothes.
Beautiful song.
Whenever, whatever. Yeah, but I remember it was like standing at in front of an abyss, you know. It was so nerve-wracking, and there was some sort of vertigo, because it was a challenge, definitely an intellectual challenge, more than anything. I think it was an intellectual challenge. And back in the day, the industry was watched by the gatekeepers, you know, the people who would decide what would make it into American radio and what wouldn't. They would decide, like, not like today, when people decide. It's like music is democratized, I think.
And
that's
today,
a huge advantage. And the Latin artists today are there's a lot of receptivity towards Latin artists, but when I first started out, there was a lot of prejudice, and people weren't that receptive. Not everyone was so receptive, you know.
Well, they say that's because of you, right? Like, those artists talk about you as being this ground...
Do they?
Yeah, I mean, you must know that. You must know they see you as a sort of...
Well, you know, it felt at times that I was, like, out there in the desert, beating rocks under the sun. It was hard work. I had to do a lot of convincing. Convincing radio station directors, convincing record executives, convincing journalists. There was a lot of prejudice against Colombians, and the industry was dominated by by men in general. There weren't that many like female pop acts in Latin America, so it was hard times, but that made it all the more interesting, I think, and challenging.
I got the rap, so
aww.
I'm sad too, man. You know, it's all right. Before I go, I don't have any. It's not a question. I promise.
No, go ahead.
Before I go, I hope you can take some time and just take some of in what you talk about your fans and how much your music means to them, but the incredible groundbreaking work you've done. Every single person I heard on this record, I thought, I don't really know if they would exist without Shakira, and there
aww.
She is with them. I love the record
so much.
It's such a great joy to get a chance to talk to you.
Oh my God.
And thanks for having me.
Enjoy this time.
I appreciate it.
Oh,
Shakira and Whenever, Wherever. What a jam. That was my conversation with Shakira. If you want to see that conversation, go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com. Search for Q with Tom Power. If you want to share that conversation with the Shakira fan in your life, subscribe to our podcast, Q with Tom Power. But yeah, we recorded that conversation at midnight in Miami. So thanks to Shakira for staying up for us. She'll be heading out on tour. I wouldn't be surprised to see her in North America sometime soon. Her brand new album, Las Mujeres, Ya No Llorarán, is out now. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. In a few minutes, you're going to hear a reading from the Canadian poet and writer Zara Nakhvi. Zara just released her debut poetry collection. It's called The Knot of My Tongue, and it's about the impact of migration, exile, displacement, and colonialism, and the quest to find a place of belonging. So Zara was born in Karachi in Pakistan, grew up in Vancouver, and like so many South Asian families all over the world, Zara's family lived through the 1947 partition of India and Pakistan, the largest mass migration in human history. Partition tore apart communities, displaced millions of people, created new borders, and resulted in the deaths of over a million people. It's the kind of history that creates ripple waves for generations, waves of displacement, of loss, of stories of survival. Zara's really interested in these stories, how the legacies of colonialism, particularly in South Asia, have this impact on families and their sense of belonging for generations that weren't even around in 1947. The poems in this collection center around language, how it's inherited and passed down and lost, and how to come to terms with belonging in this world and finding a sense of place. Zara Nakhvi joined Q guest host Talia Schlanger from a studio in CBC Vancouver to talk more about her poetry and to do a reading.
Hi, Zara. Welcome to Q.
Hi, Talia. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. The Knot of My Tongue, your debut book of poetry, is out. How are you feeling about that?
I'm feeling very relieved because it's been a long process, and I was quite nervous leading up to it. But now that it's out and it's in the hands of readers, it's actually been quite nice. It's been very special.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. It's really beautiful. And part of the story that you're telling, that you reference in a few of the poems in this collection, is how the 1947 partition of India and Pakistan had an impact on your family's story. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so both sides of my grandparents are from Lucknow, a city in India. And during the 1947 partition, they migrated, right after the partition, they migrated to Pakistan. It was a very violent and tumultuous time. And since then, every generation of my family has migrated to a new place. So there's been this long kind of legacy of leaving things behind, of displacement since then. And so I often think about what it means to belong. And I have a complicated relationship with nation states as a result of the partition. And my grandmother would tell me stories of Lucknow. I have never been back. But it's just something that's really shaped how I write and the things that I end up thinking about.
Yeah, what made you turn to poetry to process some of those things that you're thinking about?
I guess poetry has a way of holding fragmentation and silence in a way that I struggle to sort of express that in other forms, in other kinds of writing. And there is a lot of silence and fragmentation in that story and that legacy. My grandmother wouldn't say much about the partition itself, like the journey, what that experience was like. And I think that's the case for a lot of survivors of violence or displacement. There are moments that are hard to express and vocalize. And she'd been through a lot. She'd even moving to Pakistan, after she moved, she had lost a child and then another child, and she'd lost three children in her life. And what I found is that her way of expressing her emotions and her way of processing things was actually also through storytelling and narratives and tradition and ritual and poetry. So I think that's why I'm drawn to poetry. I feel it has room for that. It has room for holding that kind of silence and weaving in and turning to narratives and stories that voice and describe what you yourself cannot say.
That's so beautifully said. I wanted to ask you about language a bit. I know that you immigrated from Pakistan to Canada when you were a kid, and even though you learned Urdu when you were young, you've said that as you grew up, you forgot how to write in that language. What do you feel that you lost when you started to lose the ability to write in Urdu?
Yeah, I remember when I first immigrated, I actually wrote a letter to my cousins in Urdu. I was 7 years old at the time, and I used to be able to write Urdu very fluently. And then I never sent that letter, but later on I found it, and I realized many years later that I couldn't really read it anymore, something that I had myself written. And I think it's just, it's this feeling of disconnection from the literature, the poet, Urdu poetry, Urdu literature, that like entire culture that is expressed within Urdu verse. I've been learning and reading poetry, Urdu poetry, with my mom and with my family, but it's still not the same, and it's a process of learning again, so I can access the cultural knowledge that is lost when one doesn't have access to the literary tradition.
So in a few minutes, you're going to read us a poem from your new collection, and it's based on your family history that was so deeply impacted by partition. The poem takes place across generations. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so this poem is untitled, and it's part of, there's a longer poem that's kind of woven throughout the collection. In this particular section, section two, I'm talking about the loss of language as a result of displacement and exile. And in this poem, I draw upon different poets who are also writing about exile, including a Palestinian poet, a Kashmiri poet, and an Indian poet who was writing under British colonial rule. And my father used to recite this lines by this poet in Urdu, and so I've it's in the poem, and then I also translated those lines. Yeah,
there's a part of the poem that we're about to hear that I wanted to ask you about. It's a young father sits alone in a parking lot in the middle of a Canadian winter for an overnight security job, wonders if this is what generations of leaving has come to. Could you tell me more about those lines?
I think in the migration narrative, there's a sense that what you're leaving behind, difficult circumstances, towards something, towards a sense of belonging, towards a place that you can call home, or stability. And I think that's not necessarily always the case. I think with my parents, with my father especially, he felt a sense of loss of identity, a loss of language when he migrated to Canada. And he actually ended up moving back to Pakistan. So I think it's this complicated relationship to thinking that there is sort of a clearer trajectory after one migrates.
Yeah, or that things will be better. It's more complicated than that. There's a recurring theme of birds flying in the sky in the poem that we're about to hear. What does that represent for you in the context of the themes that you're exploring in this poem?
Yeah, I think in a lot of the poets who are writing about exile and are writing about displacement, they often use motifs of birds and the sky and ideas about escape, particularly the Iqbal poem that I translate in this collection. And I kind of wanted to push back because I understand the complicated relationship to land, especially after the 20th century sort of nationalist movements that saw the creation of, particularly in the case of South Asia, the creation of nation states and borders. And I wanted to sort of both challenge this idea of escape being the way forward, and also while also challenging borders, and try and think about what other ways of belonging are possible on the land, with the land, that might not be the violence of nation states or the need to escape.
It's a very beautiful thing to hear right now. When you're ready, would you introduce yourself and set up the poem for us?
I'm Zeher Naqvi, and this is a poem from my new collection, The Knot of My Tongue. A young man walks the streets of his childhood through signs declaring, "No dogs or Indians allowed." A woman turns one last time from a crowded, desperate train. Millions stumble into new old countries. Lines on a map tearing across centuries. A man and a woman in a refugee camp put down suitcases full of loss. Look up before they fall asleep to see the same old moon slipping across. A young father sits alone in a parking lot in the middle of a Canadian winter for an overnight security job. Wonders if this is what generations of leaving has come to. This parking lot, this unforgiving asphalt, these street lamps, swallowing the soundless, sleepless night. The poet Darwish asks, where should we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky? Shahid writes, there is a sky beyond the sky for me. In the parking lot, the young father looks up, lips remembering lines. Tu Shaheen hai, parvaz hai kaam tera. Tere saamne aasmaan aur bhi hain. Sitaron se aage jahan aur bhi hain. Abhi ishq ki intaha aur bhi hain. You are the falcon. To fly is your calling. There are more skies to come. There are realms beyond even the stars. Further heights for you to ascend. In her room, the girl has taken to lying on the floor, ear against the ground. Maybe it is not the sky, Shahid. Maybe there is more earth beyond this earth for me.
That was a Canadian poet, Zara Nakvi, reading an untitled poem from her new collection of poetry. The collection is called The Knot of My Tongue. It is out now. Zara joined Q guest host Talia Schlanger from CBC Vancouver. All right, that is it for the show today. Nice to be back, by the way. Thanks so much to Talia Schlanger for sitting in for me over the week I had off there. Tomorrow on the show, Ani DiFranco has taken on a lot of different roles over her career. Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter, social activist, entrepreneur, and now Broadway star. She'll tell you about joining the cast of the musical Hadestown and why it represents to her the path not taken. That's tomorrow on the show. If you want to get in touch with me, q@cbc.ca is the best way to do that. I'm also on Instagram, @TomJoePower. I'm not on Twitter, because why? What else? Oh, YouTube. YouTube.com. Look for Q with Tom Power, especially if you want to see that interview with Shakira, and subscribe to our podcast, Q with Tom Power, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.